Hi, and welcome to the Web Directions podcast series. The following presentation, Creating Inspired Design with Andy Clark, was recorded at Web Directions South in Sydney on September 28, 2006. For more materials from this conference series, please visit webdirections.org. This podcast is licensed by Web Directions and Andy Clark under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 2.5 license. Please include this audio license notice with any copy or derivative work of the podcast that you distribute. And now, over to Andy.
Andy Clark. Andy Clark is one of the most stylish people I've ever met. He's which is what we really look for in our designers. He's a fantastic educator, fantastic speaker, one of the most beautiful designers that I've ever seen. And he brings a huge long history of design in the offline world to the online world. And I think that's something we've started to see in the last 2, 3, 4 years. People who have had a really strong background in design and graphic design and so on, bringing those skills online, but not just with the cut, copy and paste from Photoshop approach, but really starting to use standards and accessibility. So integrating the very best of graphic design with the use of best practice standards and accessibility. And I think Andy, more than just about anyone, exemplifies that. So it's our very great privilege and my joy to introduce Andy Clark.
Morning. I'm glad to see not too many people had any Barney getting in here this morning. This is a real joy. I remember listening to the podcasts and reading all the blog posts from the last couple of years and talking to Doug Bowman and Dave Shea and thinking, you bastards, I'm going to get here one day. And it really is a pleasure, so thank you to John and Maxine for letting me come. It's also a pleasure really to not just be in Australia but to be in New South Wales, because for quite a number of years now I've had my business based in Old Wales, which for anybody that doesn't kind of know UK geography is, it's a little field just off the side of England. And it's a funny little place, and they have a kind of a funny attitude, I think, to their position in the European Union and in the world at large. And I had the pleasure of doing a job for the Welsh Assembly Government, which is kind of like a council, but sort of slightly bigger and more self-important in Wales. And I remember going down to a meeting. I did an anti-smoking campaign for them, which as a 20-a-day smoker was quite an achievement to actually get the job. And I'll just tell you a little story about what I think is the difference between what I'm seeing here in New South Wales and what I know to be going on in Old South Wales. But I went down for a meeting about this campaign, and we sat in this meeting room. And all of a sudden, there's this, the tannoy goes off, and it's bing bong. And this voice says, "This is a Welsh Assembly Government AT department warning. We have a virus entering our systems. Please could you delete all unopened email?" So of course, what everybody does, and you can just picture it, can't you? Everybody runs straight back to their desk and opens all their email before they have to delete it. So people disappear and they come back into the meeting. And about 10 minutes later, the little tannoy thing goes off again. It's bing bong. And this really stressed voice goes, "This is an IT department warning. We now have a virus running rampant in our systems." So it's great to see, it's great to see the difference between the new world and the old world. And I'm so pleased to be here. So let's do some stuff. Creating inspired design. I'm not going to talk about CSS today. I'm hardly going to mention standards. Really what I want to do is to try to do a little bit of an inspirational session, really try to encourage people to think a little bit differently about what it is that we do for a living and the different disciplines that we're all involved in. It is a visual presentation. I look at things very much from a design point of view, but hopefully some of the things that I'm going to talk about are going to be relevant to developers as well. People that may not consider themselves to be creative. I'm firmly of the opinion that whatever it is that we're doing within on the web, that we are all involved in a creative medium, even when we're writing code or we're doing visual design. Every aspect of what we do is creative. And I often get frustrated when you speak to people, don't you? They say, oh, I was no good at art at school, you know, I can never draw. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that the technicalities of actually making art mean that you're not any good at it. There's all sorts of different things that we can do, and hopefully we can bring some of that stuff in. But I am from a design background. I didn't actually pick up a computer at all until 1995, and I was I didn't do graphic design as a discipline. I was a fine art painter, and I went to art school, and thinking that I was going to be, you know, a really good painter, and I realised after about, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 days that I was really hopeless. So I spent most of the time in printmaking and in photography, and I got really involved in the process, and I really enjoyed the kind of the mechanical process of those disciplines, and it's something that I still kind of carry with me to the web. So I want to talk about some design-related stuff, some artistic-related stuff, and I was sitting in a cafe restaurant with Jeffrey Veen and Molly last September, and we were kind of mooting, discussing the difference really between art and design. And Jeffrey's definition, which was extremely elusive, especially considering the amount of Manhattans that he seemed to have consumed that evening, was that art was design without compromise. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because compromise isn't really something that we like to consider when we're making art or we're doing design. I mean, we're always kind of trying to come up with the cool stuff. And whether or not it's in visual design or within the code that we write and the web apps and the applications that we're making, I think we're always trying to outdo what we've done before or outdo our competitors. So really, the idea of working in an area where there are a lot of compromises, I don't think is something that particularly appeals. So I got to thinking about this a little bit more, and I realized that actually there are limitations and there are restrictions, really, on what it is that we do for a living. And all sorts of factors which play into the type of work that we do and the way that we approach it. And really, whether it's just to do with the fact that we're working within a fairly limited screen space, which is two-dimensional, the limitations of markup and CSS, neither of which were designed for creating the kind of rich visual interfaces that, yeah, that the modern web design demands. And then, of course, we've got poor support in old browsers. So we're struggling all the time, I think, to implement the type of stuff that we want to do. But we're always thinking about, well, hang on a minute, I need to support this, or I need to support that, or, you know, I have to go back so far in terms of browser support. So there's all these limitations that are kind of nagging away in our minds. But I actually began to realize that one of the biggest limitations that we have in terms of our own approach to what it is that we do for a living is the limitations that we kind of impose on ourselves. And really, the most important thing, I think, is that the web is only, you know, the web is only just over 10 years old. And we really know very little about actually what we're doing for the most part. And there's this whole kind of buzz about Web 2.0, as if we'd learn anything from Web 1.0. And, you know, I look at some of the cool stuff that goes on. And I look at, you know, some of these interesting and exciting apps that are coming online. There's a blog called Mashable by a guy called Pete Cashmore, who kind of just keeps documenting all of these new cool web apps. And if you actually look under the hood, and if you look at the markup and the CSS for a lot of these things, it's utterly appalling. And yet, it's all part of this kind of Web 2.0 buzz. So I think we've got a huge amount to learn. And within the industry, we are the very small minority of people that are passionate about standards and passionate about accessibility, for example. And really what we need to do is we need to start to think a little bit more about letting go of what we've done in the past and really moving forward in terms of, you know, what we can do in the future. So before we do that, I just want to pull up a couple of things. Is that familiar to anybody? This was quite interesting because when I was going back looking at some of these things, looking back at sites like this, which were really the starting point, I think, in terms of what we're doing with CSS layout today, and I don't think that any really of what we're doing would have been possible if it hadn't have been for these early pioneers, but also the fact that they shared their knowledge and they shared their experience with the rest of us, and we could then take things on and develop them further. Does anybody remember this? Okay, there's a kind of a spot prize, which I'm not quite sure what that is yet. Can anybody remember the name of the guy who actually did Blue Robot? Apart from John and Molly, who remember everything.
He doesn't know.
You don't remember? Molly?
Rob Chandonnays.
It was a guy called Rob Chandonnays, who I've never met, and I've never seen anything that he's ever done since then. But without this type of thing, without this type of work, really we wouldn't be doing the type of things that we're doing now with CSS. We wouldn't be able to have let go of table hacks for layout. The other interesting thing from a historical point of view is that both of these sites were using absolute positioning for their layouts. And we've kind of got away really from positioning a lot of the times for layouts and moved more towards floats. But personally, I think absolute positioning is back now, particularly when we can start stacking and we can start layering perhaps transparent PNG images to create some real rich visual layering. So personally, I think that absolute positioning is the new DOM scripting. It's what you're going to be reading an awful lot about next year. It's going to be the new Ajax. But CSS is, it's not just about the websites that we make. It's cropping up in all sorts of unexpected places. In things like Adium, which is a chat client for OS X. And this is all XHTML and CSS. If you actually open up the package contents and delve in, you can edit the CSS, you can create your own themes. And there's a whole bunch of different things that you can download and different themes. And it's really interesting the fact that, you know, applications are, you know, being made with standards powering in the back end. Right the way up to things like Apple's dashboard. So off the desktop and onto the web, you know, we have got an enormous amount of great stuff going on. This is just a small selection from CSS Reboot, which is a biannual event now, twice a year. And you know, hundreds and hundreds of designers will relaunch their sites, you know, on the same day. And it can be really inspiring. We get into discussions as designers about, well, this year, you know, there was a lot of white text on dark background and great big horizontal footers and that kind of thing. So it is interesting to see, you know, how these design trends keep kind of moving and flowing. But things like Reboot, CSS Reboot, really crystallize the fact in my mind that we have a huge amount of talent out there on the web doing some massively different things with what is essentially the same set of core technologies. So really my point is that it's not really about the technologies that we're using anymore, it's what we can do with them, and it's where our imagination can take them. Which of course leads me on to the Zen Garden. And I mean, has there been a presentation in the last 3 years anywhere that hasn't featured something about the CSS Zen Garden? I think there's virtually everything that could be said about the Zen Garden has already been said. But what strikes me now, going back and looking at some of these Zen Garden designs, is that it's no longer about the technology for me. It's not about the markup, because we can't change that. And you know, Dave himself has talked about, you know, how he might have done things differently now if he was doing the markup again. And it's not about the CSS. To me, it's not about the technologies at all. To me, it's about meaning. And I'm very, very passionate about the fact that we should never forget that it's the design, it's the visual design which evokes emotions, it helps our audiences engage with the sites that we create. And really, what this is a fantastic example of is the fact that we've got the same fundamental building blocks for each of these designs, but each one of them conveys a different meaning. So we often talk about semantics with markup, but sometimes we forget that exactly the same piece of content, marked up in exactly the same way, can have a huge difference in terms of the meaning that's communicated through the design. So I think we've got to remember that it's not just about the code, it's not just about whether it's valid, and it's not just about whether it's, you know, efficient use of CSS. Really, we've got to be thinking about how do we use the design to convey that deeper message? How can we get people to engage in the sites that we're making and in the apps that we're making through the use of imagery, through the use of typography, and through layout? And the Zenith Garden, for me, has taken on a different role now. It used to be that I used to use the Zen Garden for convincing people almost that standards-based or CSS-based design was, you know, could be creative. Now it's about showing clients the fact that we need to be rethinking about design. We need to be refocusing back onto design and not being obsessed strictly by the technologies. Which leads me on to this. The Web Standards Awards, which was started by Mr. Cameron Adams and Andy Budd. And I was fortunate enough to be a judge on this for a little while. And we saw some great things. Some amazingly different designs. Now, the nice thing about the Web Standards Awards was that it was a kind of a by designers, for designers site, rather than what I would generally term a CSS catalogue. You know, which you can just kind of flip through like Argos and think, I'll have one of those, thank you. There's some great work that was done with this. Huge variety of different things. And the nice thing about this was that, you know, each one was really considered by the people, that by the judges and by the people that were submitting the sites, really because we wanted to do something different. And we weren't always concerned about featuring sites that were, you know, good in the conventional sense. I mean, this is a design from a good mate of mine, Simon Collison, who writes a blog called Collie Logic. And we put this up, was this about a year and a half ago, Cameron? Something like this, and it was utterly panned. I mean, people were saying that, you know, was the layout broken? And they were trying to validate the CSS to see whether Simon had cocked it up. Just because it was different. And I really admired this site because it was just trying to do something that little bit different. It was just challenging the way that we were using the boxes and we were using the layout. And just trying to do something a little bit different. And Simon does a lot of work with record companies. So obviously they're really concerned about the brand and they're really concerned about the image that their bands portray. So they wanted this to be a little bit challenging, a little bit edgy. And again, it wasn't about the markup, it wasn't about the CSS. It was really just about, you know, doing something which talked to the audience. And I think that's something that we often forget. And it wasn't just an English-speaking thing. You know, we featured this, which was Web Browser, which is this fantastic combination of, you know, graphic design, Flash, standards, and it's just funny, you know, the humour and the way that the designers have played with shape. You know, we often talk about, you know, CSS designs being boxy. I think we've gone way past that, but just the way that the typography is being used and the way that a lot of the traditional things that we might have thought about when we were designing on paper, they've brought in, but they've made it their own, and they've used that to give the whole thing personality. So I think the key point is that we've reached a level of maturity in terms of what we're doing with markup and CSS, which led Cameron and some of the other guys to decide to close the Web Standards Awards about a couple of months ago. And unfortunately, it didn't get sold for kind of $20,000 like Style Gala or something. But really, as Cameron says in his quote, that we've arrived at a situation where beautiful sites with beautiful code are being produced by the hundreds every month, every week, every day. It's no longer a myth that you can produce a stunning site with web standards. Well, you know, Cameron's spot on. But I don't agree entirely with what he has to say for two reasons. The first reason is that I actually don't think we've even started to know what to do with the technologies that we use. There's still an enormous way to go. And, you know, the web being so young, really, you know, we need to continue to be playful. We need to continue to keep doing the kind of experimental stuff. And the web has really focused, hasn't it? The conversations that we've been having have been focused very, very much, I think, on technologies in the past. So they've been focused on standards when we're in the evangelizing phase. They've been focused on how we use technologies and how they can combine together, APIs and mashups and all that kind of stuff. But also about the science of web design. And there is this kind of view that designing for the web is akin to kind of product design. So we got into the whole conversation about usability. And, you know, no disrespect to the guy, but people like Jacob Nielsen saying, you know, this is how websites should be made. This is how they should work. And I'm positive that, you know, there are certain things that are correct in what he has to say. But do we really know, you know, 10 years in? I mean, architects carry on kind of building taller buildings. And they learn from what they've done in the past and they kind of move on. Bridge designers keep making bridges that span longer and longer lengths. They don't kind of stop halfway through and think, well, we've learned everything there is to know, so we're not going to build a longer bridge anymore. So why should we stop? And the other thing I think is that we shouldn't forget that, you know, we are a very small, hopefully vocal, but a very small minority. And when we consider what's going on in the wider world, when we consider the huge amount of people that are involved in developing and designing for the web that aren't here, that don't come to conferences, that don't understand or don't think that it's appropriate or profitable to work in standards-based methods, the job is far from done. So I think that we should be continuing to carry on the conversations and to actually increase the type of events like this and try to be more inclusive, perhaps, in terms of bringing other people from different disciplines into the conversation, because there's a huge amount of people out there for which most of the stuff that's been talked about at this conference and others will just go way over their heads. But the one thing that I do think it's important to remember is that no matter what the challenges are that we face, and those challenges, as I say, can be technological, but they can also be psychological. They can also be our own little kind of nagging voices that say, I can't do this, I shouldn't do this, my clients won't let me do this. We've really got to kind of let go of those things. But also we've got to remember that it isn't about the technologies. The technology is not an end in itself. And what we're trying to do, whatever we're making, is that we're trying to develop the products, in this case web-based products, that people actually love to use. And Kelly was talking about this in her keynote yesterday. You know, developing apps or developing sites or developing products that people want to bring into their lifestyle. And I think that that's the most important thing. And as developers and designers, we've got to remember that it's about the love and it's about getting people to feel passionate about something. And I think the passion is something which, you know, in some of the conversations, we've let slip a little bit. So creating products that people love to use. Hands up in the audience, anybody that's got one of these? Yeah. Okay, why did you buy that and not the iRiver or the Yingyong Taiwanese clone, no disrespect to Taiwan? Because these are probably made there. It's cool. You're buying the brand, aren't you? You're buying something which is not only great to use and it's functional, but you want to buy the dream. Would it have been any? Do you think it would have been different if they'd have had black earbuds, so that they looked like kind of you were carrying a Sony Walkman, Discman around, kind of like this big? Maybe not. Why have I got one? Why have I got more than one? This is the. Anybody use Delicious? Yeah, I don't. Why don't I use Delicious? Why do I use Magnolia instead? It does the same thing. I prefer Magnolia, not because it's technically any better, but because it does things to me in terms of, you know, the overall aesthetic. It makes me want to read it, and a lot of that is to do with the typography, and it's to do with, you know, the colours and the layout and just the way that it makes me feel about stuff. But I'm also buying the fact that Jason Santamaria and Jeffrey Zeldman designed it, to be perfectly honest. And maybe it's because it's not what everybody uses. Or it's not owned by Yahoo, which is another great advantage. But there's this focus, isn't there? I mean, at this conference in particular, and in others that have been going on, we've been talking a lot about web applications. And, you know, whether it's APIs or mashups or Flickr or Delicious or whatever, a huge amount of focus on web applications, and that's fine, because at the end of the day, people come onto the web often to do tasks. You know, they want to bookmark stuff, they want to buy something, they want to sell something, whatever. So it is a kind of a task-based environment, but it's not a power drill. You know, when I pull the power drill out of my shed, I want to drill holes with it. And there's bugger all else that I can do with my power drill, except drill holes in things. Well, you know, the web isn't a power drill. What?
Quiet. I'm going to ignore that. The web is not a power drill.
Yeah. How do I follow that? It isn't a power drill. It's a creative, artistic medium. And people come on not just to do stuff, but they come on to find out about things. You know, whether you're researching information and you're going to Wikipedia, or you're wanting to find out why I should spend $200 on some trainers that connect to my iPod. But you know, what a useless bloody product that is. There's probably about 100 little pedometer things. You know, get them with cereal or something, I don't know. But no, you're going to spend the money on the trainers and you're buying the brand. And there's a lot of this stuff going on outside the world of web apps and standards. In fact, I know I was talking to, again, Simon Collison, and he lives in works in a city called Nottingham, which is in the Midlands. And he's the only web standards-based designer and developer in his agency and in the city at all. So out of the entire city, there is only one company and one person in that company that does anything with standards-based stuff. And yet it's a busy place. You know, it's a nice industrial area. It's slap bang in the heart of the Midlands. And there's stuff going on all the time. And we focus a lot of the time on, you know, web apps and the details of technologies, sometimes without forgetting that, you know, I don't know what Nike's budget is for marketing on the web. More than I'll ever get paid. And they do it every 6 months. So what about the brands? What about Nike? What about Coca-Cola? What about all of the stuff that regular people go and look at? And what about all the stuff that regular people go and look at that's made by people that aren't us? So there is this wider world out there, and we need to remember that it's not necessarily just about our own small community. And we shouldn't forget that the stuff going on here, which impacts on people's daily lives in different ways, you know, people go and see movies. People going to movie sites have a different objective. If I'm going to go to a site to buy a DVD, I want it to be as quick and as easy as possible, and I want to find out whether it's suitable for my little lad, and I just want to get out of there. You know, it's not a pleasurable experience going onto Amazon, is it? It's just not the way that you want to be spending your time. Going onto sites like this and exploring and going round and visiting the village square and seeing all the stuff. I mean, pull up the Corpse Bride site You'll probably kill the Wi-Fi if everybody does it, because it's, you know, it's not the most usable site in the world, and you'll be there for ages. But maybe that's the point. And we shouldn't forget that this stuff goes on. And, you know, we can do this with standards. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be this enormous kind of flash-based stuff. I mean, I've actually recreated this site in standards-based stuff for another conference. So, you know, we can do it. It's not about the technologies that have been chosen. Really, it's about the fact that we've got to remember that there are other things that are going on outside of what we maybe consider to be our kind of core community. So I want to really think about ways that we can bring back in some of this stuff that's going on outside into what we do. And a lot of the stuff that I'm going to talk about is kind of design-based, but I would hope that as creative developers, there might be some things in here for you as well which are going to perhaps kind of help you bridge the gap between this kind of design and code dichotomy, which I do see in a lot of places. Hands up those people that kind of author with markup and CSS. Yeah, quite a few. When you're working with designers, how does it generally work for you? Do you get visual design comps in Photoshop and then kind of have to make them up? Is that a common practice within your organizations? Because quite often I see this, and it's in small agencies and large agencies. I was, for the last couple of years, I kind of combined my agency with a technical development company that was doing a lot of e-commerce stuff. It's no longer doing that. But this was a company that was kind of driven by a technical person, and there was really an emphasis on very much on process and no consideration at all for creative experimentation. So, you know, around the walls there were whiteboards that with flowcharts and kind of mantras. And it was a thoroughly bloody miserable experience. But really, what it said to me was that we're all doing this together. We're all supposed to be creating this final product, this final end result, for the good of the client and the good of the people that use it. But where in a lot of places that I go, whether it's in design agencies or in government departments or, you know, some of these larger web companies, there's this split. So you've got designers in one room, you've got technical developers who are authoring with CSS in another room, and perhaps you've got, you know, really hardcore programmers that do stuff with X's on the end, sharps and stuff. And to me, that doesn't seem to make very much sense, because at the end of the day, it's not a production line. You know, it's not like you're making a car with robots and, you know, the next bit has to go in. It should be a fluid and a creative kind of process. And I want to encourage people to, whether or not you're working in design or whether or not you're working in code, to try to think a little bit more about what the other person's doing and to, you know, understand some of the ways that they're working or some of the ways that they're thinking, so that we can start to, you know, perhaps break out of some of these boxes that we've been using to limit ourselves before. So I do stuff like this. I work a lot of the time with clients, and I ask them to get involved in the design process. And I don't know how many designers are in here, which, you know, you're working on a job and you come up with a bunch of ideas and you present them to the client, and, you know, they don't like that, so there's another revision. So what I like to do is I like to get the clients involved in actually making design decisions before we've even picked up a copy of Photoshop. So just by, you know, scouring around, you know, what's the mood that we want to create with this site? You know, do we want it to be warm and autumnal and soft, or do we want it to be hard-edged and metallic and shiny and modern? So just getting people to think a little bit more about the mood that they want to create with the sites and the emotions that they're trying to get over. And what are they trying to, what is the perception that they want the client, they want the visitor or the user to have when they come onto the site? And when you're not doing it for clients, you can be doing it for yourself. And I keep a scrapbook. And a lot of my friends do things in a slightly different way. John Hicks, for example, scans everything and stores it away in iPhoto. But I like the kind of tactile quality of finding things in magazines or seeing a little postcard stuck up in a phone booth. Oh no! I'm putting it in my back pocket. And finding this stuff, and going, yeah, that's interesting, because you never know when you're going to use it. You never know when you're going to need it. So I do like to kind of, you know, collect things and cut things out and stick things in. And I think it's a really important thing to get the kind of tactile quality of a lot of this stuff. You know, I found this this flyer for, I don't know what it is, mild spice creamy korma something, whatever it was, and it was kind of just floating around the street, and it's not come out terribly well in the scan, but it had been all screwed up. And I really like the reflective quality that there was in the way that this kind of, this very graphic-y, dark background with the circles had kind of just been broken up organically by the fact that this thing had floated down the street and got screwed up and trodden on and all sorts of things. So we can look around and we can find things and get ideas and try to bring them into the work that we're doing. And I hear an awful lot of the time, you know, the web isn't print. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't learn from what's gone on before. We shouldn't be limited by the conventions of print. But there are a ton of stuff that we can find just by kind of opening up pages of magazines and looking at them and sort of ripping stuff out. And doctor's surgeries and hospital waiting rooms are a great place to find this. There's always a stack of old magazines that you can just kind of rip up. But just looking at things and thinking about things in a different way. And it, you know, you might be thinking, well, I'm not. This isn't the kind of the area that I'm involved in. You know, I'm more into code. I'm more into markup or CSS or programming. But looking at these things and thinking, well, what can I do? What is this? Now, what are these things here? What is the meaning, the semantic meaning, perhaps, about behind some of the things that we're seeing on these pages? I got some very funny looks because I went into the local kind of corner shop and bought $20 worth of teenage girl magazines. But just looking at some of this stuff and thinking, yeah, we don't see that on the web. You know, we don't see headings that do this stuff, or we don't see typography in this way. And, you know, what is this over on the right here? Well, to me, you know, it's a form. But we don't see forms like that. And, you know, okay, there's a certain argument to say that you shouldn't muck about with user interface elements. You know, forms are forms, and you know, the buttons should always look like buttons, and the field should always look like fields. But, you know, to hell with that. Aren't we supposed to be doing things imaginatively? And if the readers of this teenage girl magazine are familiar with the conventions that they've had, they've grown up with, they've been used to when they've been flicking through their magazines, shouldn't we be thinking about bringing some of those onto the web rather than thinking, well, we're already establishing conventions on the web. All links have to be blue and users don't want to scroll and all of that kind of stuff. There's all sorts of things that we should be thinking about. And when it comes to a lot of the things that I do, in terms of e-commerce layouts, well, you know, just picking up the cookery magazines or Sunday supplements or wherever you find it, looking at things in a different way and saying, you know, okay, I don't normally see an e-commerce site which is laid out like this. And the question that I would ask is, you know, why is that? You know, is Amazon the real benchmark? You know, just because it's this kind of multi-million-dollar conglomerate success, does that mean that it's as far as it can go? And I really don't think so. So looking around and finding different things wherever you happen to be, looking at things, cutting them out, sticking them in magazines, sticking them in scrapbooks, or pinning them on the wall, can be, you know, creatively inspiring, and it can give you a different outlook and, you know, different ideas in terms of what it is that you can do. If you're a technical developer, somebody that's not really involved in visual design, but somebody that's involved in, you know, markup or CSS, it can be a really good tool. Because if you look at things like this, you can say, well, what is that? Well, it's a list. It's a list of products. How do I mark it up? It's an unordered list. Job done. In the past, what you may have done is you may have looked at a visual layout in a Photoshop comp and gone, okay, well, you know, I need a div for this and a div for this and a div for this. And you're thinking about it very much from the presentational point of view. But just practicing, you know, just looking at things that you might find elsewhere around and going, yeah, that's a list. I should be marking that up as a list and then using CSS to transform it into something which looks a little bit different. And this can be a really good way, you know, kind of Friday afternoon when there's really not a lot of work to do. You know, get designers and developers together and just practice on this kind of stuff. Just have the conversation, and it can have huge benefits. Particularly when you start to single out things that might actually be usable on the web. So, you know, wherever I go, I collect sidebars. I try to collect as many different, I've got pages and pages and pages of them. And thinking about how we can do things differently, because, you know, sidebars are pretty damn boring. But what happens if we can get the images to kind of stick out of the side? You know, what happens if we can use background images to run down one side and then push the list content, just to give us something which is slightly different? And it's incredibly important, I feel, that we've got to really open our eyes to this world of inspiration that's out there, and not really be constantly looking inwards and constantly looking at the web for our inspiration. You know, we can get inspiration wherever we go. This was taken down on the road between here and Darling Harbour the other day. And one of the things I love about Sydney is the fact that there's so much attention paid to preserving the fronts of old buildings. Even if they go ahead and, you know, put a concrete monster behind it. Just this attention to detail and the fact that, you know, you're walking down the street, you see this wonderful old brick frontage, and that might be all you see. But if you look up, then you're going to see that there's a different world up there. And quite often, you know, when we're going to work, if we're looking at, you know, we're on the route to work, and, you know, you're looking at the paper or you're fiddling with your iPod and, you know, your eyes are kind of only going on in front of your face. You know, you're seeing all the modern shop fronts, perhaps, if you're walking through the city centre. But if you look up, there's all this stuff going on. There's all these details. And, you know, in old places like, you know, the north of England, you know, you've got hundreds of years of kind of architectural detail and history, which is going on just a few feet above your head. And, you know, there's typography everywhere as well. So we think that, you know, design and code are separate. We think that, you know, programming and visual design or graphic design are kind of separate disciplines. But they're not really, because, you know, you've got typography going on out there in the real world. The guy couldn't have actually designed the side of that building unless he'd got an appreciation of both architecture and the three-dimensional space and typography. It couldn't have been done. So it really is the ultimate mashup of skills, where you can start bringing all of these different ideas and different disciplines together to create something which is cool. Now, it's also really important, I think, that what we do is to have a really good appreciation of what the guy across the room or across the desk is doing. And as visual designers, you know, we have this heritage, particularly if we're a bit older like me and we've done some stuff for print. There's this huge hundreds of years of experience in terms of bringing, in terms of learning about layout, in terms of learning about composition, and this whole experience and heritage that we've kind of thrown out with the web. Because a lot of the people that are working on the web, you know, in visual design, haven't had the experience. I mean, we're finding more and more that, you know, there are people that, you know, haven't designed with tables. You know, so the design community is quite young in that respect. So perhaps people aren't aware often of the type of type of techniques and the type of heritage which has been going on for so many years. But also the terminology is different. You know, when we're talking about code and we're talking about CSS, the terminology that we're using is different to the terminology that's been going on in the print world. So printers are going to be talking about columns, they're going to be talking about gutters, and horizontal fields, none of which really have anything to play in terms of the, you know, the specifics of the code that we're using. What we're doing is we're concerned with boxes on the web. We're concerned with content areas, with padding, with borders, with margins, and the terminology is different, and yet there is this kind of similarity in terms of what we can do. Now, particularly now with CSS, it introduces this new grid where we can start to play around with all of the facets that go into the box model and introduce these kind of new and dynamic ideas. But quite often what we end up with is that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's as far as we can go. You know, any element can be styled. It doesn't have to be a div. Any element has these properties, no matter what it is that it is, as long as it sits on the page. And we can do cool things with them. They don't have to sit side by side. You know, they can overlap, they can intersect. And now that we're able to use transparent PNGs natively with IE7, I think we're going to start to see an awful lot more about this kind of thing. And really start to think about, well, it's not the technology that's limiting me anymore. It's my imagination. I need to do this thing. I want to bring these inspirational ideas through. So why don't we see layouts that look like that? Just from the same basic grid design, we've got an enormous amount of flexibility, an enormous amount of variation in what we're able to achieve. And, you know, if you're a policeman, you probably think about grids as that kind of don't stop in it area at the traffic lights. Designers often think about grids in terms of, you know, traditional newspaper design. And that's about as far as it goes. But when we're talking about newspaper design, we're talking about a huge variety of different possibilities, all from the same substrate. It's all ink on paper. And if we go and we look around at what's going on in the world and don't just pick up the regular paper that we happen to have read for however many years, or look around the world at the same things being reused in different ways, we can see that no matter how many columns we're using in this particular format, there's a huge amount of variety in terms of layouts and design ideas that we can take from different things. And in newspaper design, the width of the number of columns is dictated by the format of the paper and the line length, the actual readable line length, something called the measure. On the web, we think, I need a two-column layout, or I need a three-column layout. Oh, 220 pixels, that's good enough. You know, and we need to kind of learn a little bit, I think, about what's gone on before, just so that we can then do new things. It's not about rules, it's about understanding the fundamentals and understanding then how we can break those rules. So we go down to things like five-column papers, different things entirely, and look around at, you know, perhaps how things are done in different languages or different cultures. This is an Iranian newspaper. And this is a mid-Russian paper. I love this. Don't be surprised if you don't see some stuff from me that kind of has echoes of some of these things in the future. But I love the way that the headline, where the most recent kind of articles come above the branding. An incredibly strong visual statement. And again, it's held together very, very neatly. But it's something that we may not see conventionally if we don't look outside and get these new ideas. And then this. Do you know which paper this is, Kaz? It is, yeah. To you, this is normal, I presume.
Yes.
To me, it's completely alien. Not only are we talking about you know, the amount of information on the page there, I mean, not just the characters, but the amount of information, but you know, the way that it's laid out vertically. I have no idea. For me, there isn't a visual focus. Where do you start reading?
Right top.
Right top. I just don't know. I just don't have a starting point for that. And I wonder, we'll have a conversation about this later on, about you know how you get on reading you know American newspapers or you know European newspapers, because I think that's an interesting point that we need to understand. But if we take something like that and we just forget about the fact that it's a Japanese newspaper, but think about what underpins it. Think about that grid. It's not a grid that we would normally have thought of in terms of using for the web. But when we take something like that and we just understand and we boil it down to its essence, we can then start to put our own content in. We can start to think about using the visual space to best present the content that we have. And we can have some you know, enormously exciting fun and experimentation just coming up with different layouts, which are all based on the same underlying structure. So what I'd like to finish up with is just to say that no matter what it is that we're doing on the web, whether it's we're making visual designs, or we're authoring with markup, or CSS, or we're doing programming, what I'd like to see is I'd like to see us really thinking more about moving things forward now, looking at inspiration from different parts of the world and from different areas of design, or perhaps you know totally unrelated areas, so that we can start to break out of this mindset that we may have got into a little bit, so that we can really make the whole Web 2.0 vision come true, not just in terms of technologies, but also in terms of our thinking. So the next time that you're walking out and about, just find something. Doesn't matter what it is. Just find something that inspires you, and then see how you can then bring that back into the work that you're doing that day or that week. So if you see something interesting like this, this was a shop front that I walked past in some city or another, and I thought to myself, well, I really like that shape. I really love the circle. It's a really interesting approach. You know, you don't see round windows combined with this very often. What can I do with that on the web? Well, maybe you can do that with it. And I don't know that that's going to be suitable for you know, anything in particular, but it makes me think a little bit differently. So I would like to finish up by saying that you know, out there is this massive amount of opportunity in terms of looking at things and finding inspiration for what we do in different ways. It's a collage, and so is the web. You know, it's a collage of people, it's a collage of technologies, it's a collage of skills. But the focus isn't really just on those technologies and on the mechanics of what we're doing or the science of what we're doing. It's knowing how to bring all of these things together and to, you know, how best to use them for the benefit of the clients and the people that are using those sites, that actually makes doing web design a fine art. So with that, thank you very much. I think how long have we got, Lisa? We've got 10 minutes for things to be thrown and questions or comments or... Has anybody got anything they want to add? Gentlemen in the front.
I was wondering if you're hearing much these days of sensibilities of the fine art world, painters, printmakers, ceramicists coming onto the web, and that sort of knowledge and that history. We hear a lot from print or architecture, but we don't hear a lot from that side of things in general.
Yeah, I mean, the question for the benefit of the podcast was, as well as architecture and the print world kind of having an influence over sometimes what we're doing on the web, what about ceramics or sculpture or some of these other kind of things? I think it's different. A lot of the kind of the three-dimensional stuff, it's quite hard for us to conceptualize. I don't think that we should really be thinking about, you know, making buttons that necessarily look like you can hit them with your fist. I don't know, I think that's an interesting thing. I think you'd have to ask them. My feeling is that we shouldn't be limiting ourselves just to kind of what we know. And this idea of collaboration, I think, is really important. You know, maybe art projects where we get people that are doing sculpture, or we get people that are doing ceramics or jewellery design or whatever involved in saying, well, okay, forget about the fact that it's a two-dimensional screen. Let's design something the way that you might design. Bring some of your ideas in, or bring some of your process in, perhaps. But it's, I think that's a very, very interesting point. I'd like to see a lot more collaboration on that. Anybody else? I can't see. Gentleman down the front.
Would you think that you should be using the same kind of design for, you know, mobile phone and basically widescreen TV? I mean, to me, that's the hard part, is trying to figure out how making the design work. That one you had with that round circle within the grid, that's cool like that. But then if you expand the text, then the circles end up broken.
Okay, so for the podcast, really, it was... Would I be thinking that, should we be thinking about design for these alternative devices, perhaps mobile devices or smaller screens? I think the key point there is that we're designing for the medium, and we shouldn't be forgetting that it is, you know, a web browser, for example. But if we're designing that experience, and we're designing that creative experience, obviously, some people don't want that. You know, if you're browsing with a BlackBerry, then you're not going to be trying to produce the same design or the same layout for all of these different devices. It's not just necessarily about the look of something. It's just about thinking about, you know, what is the best experience that I can give to these people, and again, not just the science of it, but the emotional part of it as well. Lady up there.
I was just wondering what your thoughts are on the idea that content should drive design, and at what point in the process should the design actually start?
That is a very good question. Where content comes in terms of the design process, whether it comes in at the beginning or it comes in at the end. This has been coming up a lot recently. Personally, I think that it's completely wrong to come up with the design layout and then pour the content in. I personally believe that it's about the content driving the visual design. And, you know, at the end of the day, as designers, we're trying to solve problems, and we're trying to take a bunch of stuff and arrange it in the best possible way so that people can find it easy to use or understand. And personally, I think that content is absolutely vital right at the very beginning. And when a client says, well, you know, you'll get your content at the end, you know, well, you just can't do it. You know, it's got to be something which is... How can you mark something up in a simple term? If you have a page, how can you select the right markup to use if you don't know what the content's going to be? So my own view is that we've got to be working really hard on getting content structure first. Working on the content structure and the most important... the document first, so that the document itself makes sense. But then we can start doing the dressing and creating this kind of emotional layout that we can best describe it. Anybody else? Is there a hand up the back there? No. You're all very quiet this morning. Is it only me drinking the Red Bull? Lady up there.
I've got a question. What's your balance between inspiration, part of what you're designing, and then the functionality of it? Like, if you've got an application that's going to be used by a lot of people with a tool, perhaps they might not want to see a different look every time they go in there.
That's a good point. You know, what is the balance between creative design and functionality and usability? You know, if I want a power drill, then I want a nice and easy to use power drill with a big button that says push and that will pull. You can tell how often I use a power drill, can't you? And I sort of push the button, or pull it, pull the trigger, and it drills things. Yeah, that's what I want. I want to be able to get the tool, plug it in, use it, and put it away again. It's not a fashion statement. Yeah, I don't walk around, well, actually, I do sometimes. I don't walk around with my big tool. You know, different tools for different jobs. I think that we shouldn't be forgetting that, you know, even a drill is designed, though. And, you know, whether it's, you know, green and smooth and ergonomic and good to hold, these are really important issues. But, you know, we're not just limited, you know, when we're designing stuff, you know, we're not just limited to functionality. You know, we want to create these objects of desire as well. Because when the guy walks into the hardware store looking for the drill, you know, he wants to, you know, he's making a decision at that point, not just on how easy it is to use, but, you know sometimes even on the packaging. So there's a balance, I think, is the short answer. How long have we got? We've got time for one more? One more. Oh, the agony of choice.
I'll go.
Yep. Well, I tell you what, you fight it out. Come on.
IE7. Is there a kind of timeline that you've got that you're working to where you think it's going to flip across, or is IE6 always going to be something that you have to?
Oh, how long is it, to summarise your question, how long is it going to be before IE7, we can forget about all the headaches and the limitations of IE6? Well, again, that depends case by case on your browser matrix and on the on what people are using to access your site. My own personal belief is that it doesn't matter to me, to be perfectly honest. It's because I don't take the view that things have to look the same across all browsers. So at the moment in the projects that I'm working on, my benchmark is standard savvy browsers, which includes IE7. IE6 users will get a slightly cut down experience. It won't look horrible, but already I'm kind of, you know, watering down the design for IE6. And it just gets progressively less and less until we drop down to Netscape 4, and IE5 Mac is another browser that personally I choose, unless it's in the client's browser matrix, to just give a plain text version to. But I think the key point is that we need to remember that we don't need to get exactly the same design and the same experience for everybody using every type of browser. But, well, we can't. You know, we saw with Kelly and a different mobile phone things yesterday, you know, it just isn't possible. So just understanding that we've got to do the best for the best and trickle things down, I think is it takes the headache away. We're not trying to hack to make everything look the same. So with that, I think that was the final question, Lisa, was it? There was just one thing that I want to do. It's always nice to be up after the prize draws. Whenever I go to conferences, I mean, you know, you guys pay, but I get so much out of coming to these things and talking to people and learning. And, you know, I wouldn't do what I do if I didn't get a tremendous amount of inspiration from everybody that comes to these things. So I like to give something back. And I usually like to come to conferences and give something to a particular person that's really kind of inspired me or helped me or, you know, in some way allowed me to kind of stand up here. So is Andrew Crispanis in the room? You're over there. Andrew, can you join me up here? No, I'm not gonna blame you. Andrew, because Andrew, I'd like to give you my pants. Signed by all the speakers.
Oh, cool.
So
come on.
So with that, thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed Creating Inspired Design with Andy Clark. For more materials from the Web Directions Conference series, please visit webdirections.org.